Okay, I have 9 o'clock on my screen, although obviously more are signing in now. So let me begin. As always, just call your attention to a few things. This week's Forward has a front page story about the text of an exorcism, that is the formula used to exorcise a demon. Actually, it wasn't a demon. It was the spirit of this woman's former husband that comes from the Cairo Geniza, and this dates to the 18th or 19th century. There's many things that were in the Cairo Geniza were placed there after medieval times, all throughout history. So you can probably find this online. Couple more things. So one of you asked me what I mentioned about the Chafetz Chaim and the Talmud Yerushalmi, the forged Yerushalmi. It's actually, you can find the information in here, in the writings of the Chafetz Chaim in the introduction. His son tells how between World War I and World War II, he was living out in the Ukraine among Hasidim, and he started wearing a tefillin of Rabbeinu Tam. And his son thought that the reason was because he was living among the Hasidim, so he wanted to do like the Hasidim were doing. But his son asked him, though, and it turns out that the Chafetz Chaim's reason was that the tractate Menachos of the Jerusalem Talmud had recently appeared, and in there, there's a passage that gives Rabbeinu Tam's, the order of Rabbeinu Tam. And that's why he was wearing it. And the son describes how he explained to his father that this was a forgery, it had been disproven, and therefore the Chafetz Chaim stops wearing tefillin of Rabbeinu Tam. Now, fascinating that Rav Avadia Yosef, in Yabia Omer, Volume 3, for those who want to check it, page 10, he calls attention to the fact that the Chafetz Chaim was unaware, his son also was unaware, of the fact that the Raivad, in one of his works, quotes the Yerushalmi Kutchin, the Jerusalem Talmud Kutchin, which is lost, as having this very point. And that's where, Rav Avad Yosef says, presumably that's where Friedlander got it. There's no question that's where Friedlander got it. The Yerushalmi Kutchim, as I mentioned last class, is a collection of sources, first of all, from the Bavli, and also there are various references to this lost Talmud, this lost Jerusalem Talmud of the Order Kutchim, found in various Rishonim, and Friedlander took these texts and stuck them into the forgery he did. So that's where he got this. It's a bit unusual that the Chafetz Chaim would be unaware of this. It appears actually in, just to give you the reference, it's in the Raivad's commentary to Sefer Yetzirah. I don't know if that was in the library of the Chafetz Chaim. So it's not so unusual that he'd not be aware of this. By the way, on this book I have, I still have many things I haven't gotten to yet, but I still have my page here because I had mentioned that the Chafetz Chaim's wife never benched. And I saw that, and I've yet to find, I didn't take it down the reference, so I don't know where it is. But if any of you know it, or you keep looking, I'll keep looking for it. I did look for it at the end of last semester, and what I found was on page 13 of the son's description of his father. He says that my mother never davened, even though, as we know, according to Jewish law, women are supposed to daven once a day, although in practice they never did. And he says, my mother never davened when we were growing up because my father, patra mizeh, that is, the Chafetz Chaim, patered her from this because she was busy raising the children. But there is a place where the son also mentions that his mother never benched, that she sat next to her husband and was yotzei in that. We dealt with this whole thing. I don't know if his mother even knew how to read any Hebrew. Two more things before we start. There's a lot to do today. This is the last day of the semester. I can send anyone who's interested in this. Memories of the Kehillas Frankfurt of my youth. We've done a lot dealing with German Orthodoxy, so I thought I'd call attention to a couple things relevant to things we did in previous classes that some of you might find interesting. This person, Willy Neuberger, who passed away a couple years ago, was a Macher, a president of the Golders Green, of the Vigshul and Golders Green, known as Monk's Shul, which is a German Hirschian Shul. Just to give you a sense of what the Kahila was like, the Hershey and Kahila in Frankfurt. And I don't know, maybe some of you attend the Washington Heights show. You can tell me if the things still go on. First of all, there was no shuckling. If any young man coming back from Eastern Europe tried to shuckle, he explains how the gabbai would pat him on his shoulder and say, "We don't shuckle here." So good German decorum, there's no shuckling. Then he also describes how dancing, there was no dancing in that show on Simchas Torah. They would bring the Sifrei Torah out in a very dignified fashion. They'd march around the shul, and then they'd put them back. No dancing. He continues to describe, but we spoke about the conflict between the Hirshian community and the what we call the Gemeinde, the general community. And in a future class, I'm going to deal with the Matei Levi, Mordechai Horovitz, and also Nechemia Noble. And we'll deal about the great controversy. And in the general community, they had an Erev. And of course, with every good Erev, you need to have people apostolate. And the Hirshian community refused to carry in it. It's the same thing, by the way, today in Washington Heights. There are two Erevs in Washington Heights. There's a YU Erev, and then there's an Erev right in the Breuer section there, and they don't hold of any of them. And he explains that he's talking about in the 1920s and 1930s that it was even frowned upon for someone of the Hirshian community to marry one of the Orthodox people in the general community because of this great dispute, especially with the Erev. He says something interesting also about a halachic thing. When they sold their chametz, and I'd be fascinated to know, well, be curious to know, I mean, whether this was done in Washington Heights. When they sold their chametz to the non-Jewish caretaker, they actually gave him a key. Like a key to the room where the chametz was locked in, or the key to the house. If it's in the house, you have to get in. I have never heard of anyone in America, and maybe one of you is going to send me a note here at the bottom, I've never heard of this notion that you give a key to the non-Jew, that he should be able to enter and take the chametz anytime. I'm not saying no one does it. They did it, obviously, in Frankfurt, but that it makes a lot of sense. After all, if it's a real sale, he should be able to have access to it whenever he wants, but I've never heard of such a thing before until I read this. And finally, he concludes by describing how when we deal with the general community in Frankfurt, I'll talk about how the separatist community was a bit of German elitism there. They did not treat the Polish immigrants, the Ostjuden, very well. And he mentions this here, that although we saw to their physical needs, we did not treat them very well. And that explains why in the general community, all the immigrants joined the general Gemeinde. They didn't join the separatist community. By the way, on the last page, he has a picture of, you could see here, all the names of members of the community. That is the Hirshian separatist community, not the general Frankfurt Jewish community. There's about 50 here, maybe more, who were killed during World War I. I have two more minutes. See, a couple other interesting things. I mentioned Rav Avram Shapiro and how the principal of the local school here is a student of his, and I just read his eulogy of Rav Avram Shapiro, and he mentioned something also I think is interesting. When Ritzi Yehuda was in the hospital, Ritzi Yehuda wanted to have, or when he was ill and then he was at home, he wanted to have a minyan. The problem was that the minyan, he wasn't always ready to daven, so they'd have to wait till he got up. And that would be after the time of davening. We spoke about this issue already. So Rav Avram didn't know what to do. On the one hand, you want to give Ritzi Yehuda a minyan. On the other hand, you can't daven after the time. So he came up with a compromise that anyone who is from a Hasidic family, they could go form the minyan, because after all, their tradition is not to pay attention to these halachos anyway. But the people not from a Hasidic family would not be permitted. Okay. There's other things I want to get to, but I'll do that next semester. Dovi Hoffman called my attention to this new book, Mayan Omer. I had the first four volumes. Two new volumes just came out. I mentioned this in the past, but for those who weren't in the previous classes, this is one of the people, the secretaries to Rav Avadya Yosef, who's asked him literally thousands of questions. Rav Avadya has these days where anyone can come ask questions, and they give him the questions, he asks them, and there's a number of very interesting things here, including dealing with Ashkenazim and what they have to follow of the Shulchan Aruch related to Kitnios and the like. But I'll hold this off till next semester. We need to return to the Ridge Baz, though. Let me see. So Chaim tells us that Rav Willig requires it. Okay, that's interesting. Okay, I'm glad. I know that you say Rabbi Billet does. Well, he requires it. Does anyone actually, you mean to sell it with him? You're obligated to give him the key? Okay, you know, this raises an interesting point, though. Because why would Rabbi Billet require this? Why would Rabbi Willig require it? Rav Soloveitchik never required it. The other Gedolim never required it. This is an example of one of the new things. Now, I understand in Frankfurt, okay, so that was a Gedol. Hirsch probably instituted this. But this notion that, today, this shows, as I've said many times, that Orthodoxy is very dynamic. It changes, and this idea that this is all about the traditions of the past is completely false. If you want no better example of this, you mentioned Rabbi Willig, so I'll tell you, go to Yeshiva University. Go daven there one day. And you will see that when it's time for Shemona Esrei, they do not face the Aron. Because the Aron is not exactly east. And if you look in the Mishnah Berurah, the Mishnah Berurah tells you in such a situation, you shouldn't face the Aron. You should face east, but you shouldn't turn your back to the Aron. You should face it like on an angle. And yet, 40 years ago, when Rav Soloveitchik was davening there, 30 years ago, not just Rav Soloveitchik, David Lifshitz, all the other Gedolim at YU, everyone faced the Aron Kodesh. In the last 20 years or so, after the passing of them, it's begun to change. And it happens slowly. Maybe it's Rav Schechter, maybe it's others. But those who've been at YU for 30, 40 years can see a change. When the Rav was alive, no one would ever dream of changing the minhag of the shul. So things change. Rav Billet keeps it in his drawer, doesn't give it to the buyer. Well, how does that help? The whole point is that the buyer is supposed to have it, so the buyer can go in and get it. Why should Rav Billet keep it in his drawer as opposed to me keeping it in my drawer? I don't see how that changes anything. The whole point is, as I said, that the Chiddush in Frankfurt was that it's a real sale, and therefore you need to give it to him. Okay, so Rabbi Blau is a Talmud of the Rav, so he follows it. I guarantee you, if you said 30 years ago that when the Rav is no longer with us, within a short couple of years, people would stop, not just the Rav, though, this is all the Rabbanim there, and they faced this way from the day the yeshiva was built. What was that, the 1920s? If you told them that all of a sudden people would stop following the minhag, they wouldn't listen to you. But for us who have a historical perspective, we know that he could be the Gadol Shebigdolim. And if he says something within a couple of years after his passing, it doesn't matter. New practices can arise. Very dynamic. So now you say, Rav Lifshitz did face. Very interesting. Okay, the new base medrash. Okay, let's return back to the Ridbaz. There's a lot to do. We're dealing with the Kashrus issue. We're going to return to the Kashrus issue there. How he arrives in town, and he takes over. I mentioned that the Rabbi Album, who was very offended by everything the Ridbaz did, he was not even making any money off this. And the Ridbaz comes to town with the Agudas Rabbanim's backing and declares that his Hashkacha is no good. Now, Album says in this book that... right after saying they didn't take any money for it, he also says the Ridbaz took away my parnasa. What does that mean, the Ridbaz took away his parnasa? If he tells you he wasn't making any money from supervising the butchers, I think what it means is what we said, how did rabbis make parnasa in those days? They made it from selling chametz, from doing weddings, etc. If the Ridbaz comes to town and tells everyone that Rabbi Album is not reliable, who's going to then ask him to sell their chametz or be Masada Kedushin? Basically, no one's going to want anything to do with him. Or I shouldn't say no one, because he still had his followers, but there will be people, those who follow the Ridbaz won't want anything to do with him, and that's what hurt his Parnassa. We will return to how this Kashrus issue played out, but I mentioned, and this is how we ended last class, that in the midst of the great attack on the Ridbaz, two volumes of Divrei Emet, he doesn't just attack the Ridbaz for his fraudulent statements, as he claims, with regard to Kashrus and other things. He goes into detail of the Ridbaz's religious ideology, and he attacks him for the statement I read last class, where the Ridbaz attacks Rav Chaim Soloveitchik. And we have to examine this again. How could anyone be opposed to Rav Chaim Soloveitchik? To say, as Ridbaz said, that it's better to have a yeshiva without a Rosh Yeshiva than to have a Rosh Yeshiva that teaches in accordance with the chemical method. And in his ethical will, if you recall, He states that none of his children should have anything to do with what he called chemistry. Such terrible assaults on Rav Chaim Soloveitchik and the whole Brisker method. So we have to talk a little bit about this method, the Brisker method, why the Ritzbaz is so opposed to it, and then we'll return to how the Ritzbaz uses this as an example of the Ritzbaz having no respect for the Gedolei Torah, for great Torah scholars. Obviously, if the Ritzbaz has no respect for Torah scholars, you can't take him seriously when he says that I, that is Rav Shimon Tzvi Albom, are not reliable, because he says that the great sage, Rav Chaim Soloveitchik, and the other great sages are not reliable. So the whole point that Albom is trying to show is that the Ritzbaz doesn't have respect for anyone. So when you're dealing with someone like that, his opinion is not as significant. Sure, Rabbi Hirsch, there were other critics of Lomdos, the Marcheshes, but the other ones were not so... for the most part, they criticized the Lomdos. They didn't criticize the personality. They didn't say things like, it's better to have no Rosh Yeshiva. The Soloveitchik family took this very personally. I don't know, Rabbi Hirsch, if you remember this. When we were at Rabbi Yonah Reese's wedding, we were speaking to Rabbi Harlap, and he told us some stories about this. One of them that was one of the students, this is from the 1950s, quoted the Ritzbaz. The Rav went crazy and said, don't ever quote him. And he said, some Gedolim are always right, some are sometimes right, and some are never right. And the Ritzbaz was never right about anything. And then the student quoted the Ritzbaz again, and the Rav lost it. He went crazy at this student because from the Soloveitchik's perspective, the Ritzbaz was their big enemy. He was the greatest opponent of their method, and he spoke publicly about it. I'll get back to that. Well, let's talk about this Brisker method, and what was it that would that would lead to such harsh criticism and that get the Brisker so upset? Well, those of us who've studied Torah know that there's different approaches to it, different trends, and changes in it. So just look in the medieval France, for example, the Tosafistic revolution of the Tosafists. That's a new approach. Combinations of philosophy and Talmud study. Pilpul, which starts a few hundred years ago and becomes so extreme that it almost becomes a game. There's one example, I should have brought it, of extreme Pilpul. One sefer says, I'm going to give you 50... options this way and 50 options the other way. So you have lots of different approaches to Torah study, which created conflict. What was Rav Chaim Soloveitchik's approach? It was a very conceptual, very analytic approach, really developed by Rav Chaim Soloveitchik. Rav Chaim's dates are 1853 to 1918. He becomes Rosh Yeshiva very young at the Volozhin Yeshiva, and already then he is unique. His shiurim are at a very high level. It quickly conquers the yeshiva world, creates a revolution. Now, he did not create this approach ex nihilo. Sosa Choshen, you have other works that deal in concepts. Rav Chaim Soloveitchik loved the Minchas Chinuch. The Minchas Chinuch, in his lifetime, was not regarded as a significant work. However, a lot of it has to do with the Rav Chaim Soloveitchik and others who pointed to the Minchas Chinuch as an important work. There's no doubt, though, that this method reaches its polished state, its most exalted state, in Rav Chaim's hands. And I think you can say, I don't think you need to be a follower of the Briskers to agree, though, that in Rav Chaim's hand, the Brisker method really raised the level of Talmud study to heights not seen since the medieval period of Tosafists. If you look at the Brisker Chakiras, it's really scientific. And when the Rav describes it as being scientific, it is scientific, for reasons we'll see. Really without parallel in previous generations. Now, whether it's true or not, that's a different question. I'll read to you in a few minutes what Rabbi Yaakov Weinberg says about the Brisker method. But it's very scientific. Yeah, Barak, the Chazon Ish was opposed to the Brisker method. That's true. We know that because of his notes on Rav Chaim that were published after his death. Whether the Chazon Ish wanted these to be published or not is debatable. Tzvi Yehuda, I mentioned this when we dealt with the Chazon Ish, he was witness to times when Rav Chaim would make negative comments about the yeshiva way of learning. But we have to remember, the Chazon Ish never learned in the yeshiva. He was not under this influence. Lawrence Kaplan, one of his articles, states that he quotes a perceptive observer, I think, who says that the Chazon Ish's problem was that he judged Rav Chaim by the wrong criteria. He judged Rav Chaim by whether Rav Chaim's explanations were true. And if you're going to judge them true, as in historically true, of course you're going to come to this conclusion. At least that's what this observer says. We'll get back to this in a minute, then when I read you what Rabbi Weinberg says about it. Yeah. I don't know, Ramosha. Ramosha, he quotes Reb Chaim Soloveitchik in his abortion shuv, if I recall correctly, and he quotes Reb Chaim other times, but he's not one of these. Ramosha too really didn't have this experience in yeshivas, so he's not a follower of the method. One other important thing that Reb Chaim did was that he transformed the Mishnah Torah. The Mishnah Torah is the halachic work par excellence. Just look at the introduction to the Mishnah Torah. The whole point of the Mishnah Torah was to be a practical halachic work to end all machlokas, to end all disputes. He transformed the Mishnah Torah, that is, Reb Chaim, from the practical halachic work par excellence to the ultimate theoretical text. In fact, Reb Chaim's theoretical analyses are based on the Mishnah Torah. That's where it all begins. And Reb Chaim shows how the Mishnah Torah is the most profound commentary on the Talmud. So for Reb Chaim, the Mishnah Torah is not about practical halacha. It's reading the Mishnah Torah as a commentary on the Talmud. You see how the Rambam understood the various halachot. It's really irrelevant what the practical halacha is from the Rambam. In fact, for the Briskers, the practical halacha is completely irrelevant. If you look at Halachic Man of Rav Soloveitchik, he describes how the theoretical halacha is the longing for halacha, not the practical halacha. And all the more so with regard to the Rambam. Today, the Rambam is central in the shiurim of Rosh Yeshiva. And that all goes back to Reb Chaim. Reb Chaim made the Rambam central, and therefore, when you look at Rosh Yeshiva today, you look at their Talmudic works, they usually begin with the quote the Gemara and then the Rambam. These are the shiurim that they give. The Rambam is now no longer about practical halacha. It's no longer something you come to at the end to know what the halacha is. It's front and center to your Talmudic analysis. As can be expected, though, with anything new, any new approach, it met with opposition from many scholars. I think it's fair to say that there was a great deal of jealousy, at least from some of the scholars, and small-mindedness. I don't think we should be surprised that some scholars who were not at the level of Reb Chaim were jealous of both his following and of his ability to create chidushim of that, and then attempted to destroy his influence. On the other hand, we have to acknowledge that there were important sages, Gedolei Yisrael, who also distanced themselves from Reb Chaim's method of study. First of all, they believed that it was a danger to the traditional approach, as the Ridvaz will say. We have a tradition on how to study the Talmud. And Reb Chaim is coming up with something new. In traditional society, anytime you come up with something new, there's going to be problems. People are going to object to it. I also assume that there are scholars who recognize the value of Reb Chaim's method, but assume that this is something only Reb Chaim can do. In the hands of the students, it would become verbal gymnastics. I'll give you some examples of that in a minute. I mean, there was a precedent for this type of fear. Pilpul originated from Gedolei Yisrael. And yet, after a few generations, all the students were doing it and coming up with all sorts of wacky and far-fetched approaches, extreme pilpul, which had no resemblance to real Talmud study. And the sages criticized this. I think it's also possible that some of the harsh criticism of Reb Chaim was from people who didn't know the method firsthand. Let's not forget, Reb Chaim's Chidushim were only published after his death. I forget the year exactly. You can look at the beginning. I believe it was 1931, it's later than that, actually, I think. I think it's about 1931, they're first published. So until then, all you knew about Reb Chaim never published in Torah journals, they didn't have that in those days. All you knew about Reb Chaim was what the students came back to their cities or what they quoted from Reb Chaim. And presumably there's a good deal of distortion in that. So they're not seeing it firsthand. They're hearing about these new ideas that are taking place in this Belajan Yeshiva, new approaches to Talmud study. You can imagine the traditional sages are going to be upset with this. New approaches? What's going on here? We're supposed to teach the way our sages in the past taught, not these new approaches. Also, and this needs to be said, the great pride, even exaggerated pride, which students took in their master's ability would have led to criticism, harsh criticism. Let me just give you what Rav Soloveitchik has to say. And I know he's two generations after Rav Chaim, but the same approach of the Rav is found in his uncle, the Brisker Rav, and all of the great students of Rav Chaim. Although they might not formulate it as elegantly as Rav Soloveitchik did, this was the ideology in the Brisker school. Rav Soloveitchik, and so what is one who doesn't belong to Rav Chaim Soloveitchik's school? Among his followers, if you're not one of them, what are you to make of Rabbi Joseph B. Soloveitchik's statement? Quote, he says this in his eulogy, his hesped for the Brisker Rav, Ravelvel Soloveitchik. The Torah was married to Rav Chaim while betrothed to the other sages of his generation. Just think for a minute what this means. The Torah had nisuin with Rav Chaim and was only engaged to everyone else. That is, everyone else... it was like kissing the bride through the veil. You know, only Rav Chaim was married to the Torah. All the other Gedolim, since they were not exposed to Rav Chaim's method, they were not married to the Torah. You can see why, like a Rav David Cohen, who at this eulogy got up and started protesting, what was upsetting them? Are you saying that the Chasam Sofer was not married to the Torah? Are you saying that the Netziv was not married to the Torah? That somehow that they were not really, they hadn't entered in, to use the Rambam's analogy with philosophy, they were still outside the palace, they hadn't actually walked into it. That's what he says. And you could see how this is going to create a backlash. What about his statement, quote, Rav Chaim knew how to learn better than many of the Gaonim. And then he says, excluding famous Gaonim like Rav Chai Gaon. Say Rav Chaim knew how to learn better than Gaonim? Let me read you, by the way, Rav Chaim's father, the Beis Halevi, he said as follows. He used to say, I was born before Matan Torah. I was born before the giving of the Torah. Let me read you, though, some of what, one thing that Rabbi Chiyak of Weinberg quotes from the Rav. He knew him, and then I'll quote you a little bit more later. He knew Rabbi Soloveitchik from Berlin. He quotes Rabbi Soloveitchik, and you can find these texts in my book, Studies in Maimonides and His Interpreters. I quote them in I have some letters from Rabbi Weinberg in the back. He says, I once asked Rabbi Soloveitchik in Berlin, who's greater, the Vilna Gaon or Rav Chaim? And he replied that when it comes to Havana, understanding, Rav Chaim is even greater than the Vilna Gaon. And Weinberg goes crazy. He says, oh, it's not true, it's not true. But there you get a sense of how the Briskers thought about Rav Chaim. Now, I will return in a few minutes to more of what Rabbi Weinberg says, because Rabbi Weinberg is going to posit that although Rav Chaim's Navalei, his Chidushim, are not true, that is, are not historically true, they are still very significant and have great Torah value. How something can have great Torah value if it's not true might seem paradoxical. We will return to that in a few minutes. Obviously, the Ritzbaz didn't share Weinberg's perspective. Now, Rav Chaim and his students, his colleagues and students, believed that even though there's novel elements in what they were doing, perhaps, it's only in the method, not in the conclusion. What they were doing, in their opinion, was revealing what was latent in the sources. That is, they're not saying anything about the Rambam that isn't there. It's there just waiting to be brought out. The fact that it hasn't been brought out for the last 800 years doesn't change that. This is the meaning, I have no doubt, this is the meaning of Rav Elchanan Wasserman's famous statement. Rav Elchanan Wasserman is quoted this way, and it's a famous statement of his, and Rav Elchanan, the important student of Rav Chaim, that it's not our role to create chidushim, to create novel insights. That's the role of the medieval authorities. Our duty is only to understand the words of the Rishonim, the medievals. So if that's the case, then what are we doing? Isn't the whole point of being studying Talmud is to create new insights? No. From Rav Chaim's position, I believe this is Rav Chaim's position also, we're not creating anything new. We're simply revealing what is latent, what is already in the source, which hasn't been seen. But that's not new. That's not the same thing as the Rishonim, the medievals, were coming up with completely new insights into the Talmud. The Rav, Rav Soloveitcher, doesn't have this perspective. If you look at Rav Soloveitcher's understanding of Chiddush, it's really about creating new insights, and that's basic to Talmud study. I think Rav Schechter is troubled by this, or has a more conservative position, because he portrays the Rav in a different perspective. And if you look in Lawrence Kaplan's review of Nefesh HaRav, he calls attention to what really is revisionism on Rav Schechter's part in inserting that Rav Soloveitcher was not really interested in creating real insights, but in really revealing what's latent, that is following Rabbi Hanan's position. But if you look in the Rav's own writings, Halachic Man and the other ones, it's clear that he believes that that's the essence of Torah study, actually coming up and revealing new insights. I think you can also find this in perhaps in the introduction to Rav Chaim on the Rambam. The sons, I don't know what that means, the sons. It's signed by the sons. I don't know which one of the sons wrote it. And they say there that Rav Chaim's work on the Rambam illuminates the eyes of Torah scholars with his method, quote, in accordance with the approach taught to us by our teachers, the Rishonim of blessed memory. In other words, Rav Chaim is only continuing the path of the medieval authorities. I think, obviously, they would acknowledge, though, that Rav Chaim is creating an analytical framework in which best to understand the medieval authorities. Now, the opposition to this new approach was not able to hold its ground. And within a very short time, all the yeshivas had Rashi yeshiva who were teaching in accordance with this method and alterations of it. Slightly different approaches. For example, the Tell's approach is a little different and other approaches are different. But the analytic approach was here to stay. One of Rav Chaim's students, Rabbi Yehuda Leib Dan Yechia, described the Shiurim of Rav Chaim as follows, quote, he would approach every Talmudic theme as a surgeon. He would first search out the logical elements of every sugya, showing the strengths on one side and then the other. After the logical basis was clear to all listeners, he would then focus on a dispute in the Talmud, or between the Rambam and the Ravid, and explain it in accordance with two divergent logical approaches. This is very important. One of the major points of dispute in traditional learning is the Rambam and the Ravid. And traditionally, what you do is you look at the Rambam and you either try to defend the Rambam against the Ravid's criticisms, or you try to show how the Ravid's correct and the Rambam is difficult. Rav Chaim didn't do that. He didn't try to bring proofs to support one side or defend one side against the other. Rather, he attempted to clarify the divergent understandings of each side. So, in other words, the Ravid criticizes the Rambam. Rav Chaim isn't interested in defending the Rambam or helping the Ravid. He's interested in showing you, based on what presuppositions and how the Ravid read the Talmud, he came to this understanding, and how the Rambam, based upon his presuppositions understanding, he came to this understanding, so there no longer is a dispute. It's not that, because we're not interested in practical halacha, remember, is no longer a dispute in how to understand the law, because it all depends on how you understand the Talmud. Each comes from a different perspective, so now that we understand the Ravid's perspective, he had to assume this way, and the Rambam's perspective, he had to assume this way. The Rav Chaim doesn't need to go any further and determine which way of reading the Talmud is correct. That's not what he's interested in. Who's he to say that? Rather, he's here to clarify for us why the Rambam has his perspective and why the Ravid has his perspective. Now, the Beis Halevi said something very funny to Rav Chaim. This is brought down in a number of sources. Beis Halevi said, when someone asks me a kasha, a difficulty in the Talmudic text or on the Rambam, and I give him an answer, everyone is satisfied. The person who asks me is satisfied because he sees that he asked a difficult question, and so he's happy. He pointed out that's a big thing in Talmudic learning, to be able to point out a difficulty. And I'm happy because I was able to come up with a good answer. He says, but you, Rav Chaim, when the questioner asks you a question like this, points out a difficulty, and you give an answer, no one's happy. The questioner's not happy because you show them there never is a difficulty in the first place. It's not a kasha. There's no difficulty. And you can't be happy because you didn't succeed in solving a difficulty, because at the end of the day, you showed that there wasn't a difficulty to begin with. So therefore, no need for a question. All you did is show why each authority held the position they held because of their own divergent understandings of the Talmudic text. So therefore, there's no need for an answer. And Rabbi Hanan again has the same perspective. Rabbi Hanan says, when there's a dispute on Tosfos, if you find an answer to this dispute, this is a direct quote, when people find an answer to a difficulty posed by the Tosafists, this is not a discovery but a loss. They have lost the shot of the Tosafists' words. When the Tosafists ask a question, let's say on Rashi, and you come up and give an answer, you've lost the point because the Tosafists know more than you. If you can come up with an answer to explain Rashi, obviously the Vayei Tosfos doesn't come up with an answer. That's not the point. Obviously you don't understand pshat to the Tosfos then, if you can come up with an answer, because we're at such a low level, we could never come up with an answer. Rather, the point is to be able to understand the question of Tosfos. And then if we can, you know, we can clarify what Rashi's coming from, perhaps, but we're not answering the question. Now another reason, perhaps the most important, for the popularity of the Chaim's method, and this I'm following Rabbi Soloveitchik, is that until then, the halacha had been studied in detail to know how to act. Asuki shematata riba dehilchata. You studied this to know how to perform in the real world. What Rav Chaim did was he took halacha and turned it into an ideal structure. And let me read you an amazing quote by Rav Soloveitchik in Halachic Man. Rav Soloveitchik, if you read Halachic Man, you get a sense for Jewish law, the study of halacha, as an ideal structure. Every now and then, people need to leave the Beit Midrash and become rabbis, and therefore they need to dirty their hands and decide practical halacha. But Halachic Man doesn't want to do that. He doesn't want to be brought down. It's like the difference between a professor of medicine and a doctor. The ideal is to remain in the theoretical world. This is very different than Rav Avad Yosef and others, that the ideal is to actualize and practice what you learn. No, for the Lithuanian, traditional Lithuanian Torah students, especially since the days of Rav Chaim, it's all about the theoretical halacha. This is Rabbi Soloveitchik, quote, suddenly the pots and the pans, the eggs and the onions disappeared from the laws of milk and meat. The salt, the blood and the spit disappeared from the laws of salting. The laws of kashrus were taken out of the kitchen and removed to an ideal halachic world constructed out of complexes of abstract concepts. In other words, before Rav Chaim, who would study Yoredei? You study Yoredei, you need to know what the halacha is. After Rav Chaim, when you're studying Yoredei, it's not about in the real world what you're going to do if the spoon falls in the milchik, the fleishik spoon. It's about the concepts. What is it about a milchik spoon and a fleishik pot that a certain amount of kosher turns something treif into kosher? It's all conceptual now. And therefore it has nothing to do with the real world of people who need to go into the rabbin and all that. It's Torah study on the same high level as Bab Metziah, as the sugyas in the order of Nashim. That's what he did. He turned practical halacha into theory. Now since the Navalei, the Chidushim of Rav Chaim, were never published in his lifetime, as I said, his reputation comes from his students. And this is a reputation that he was logical. And from his time, Rosh Yeshiva ceased. I'll give you an example. Before him, if you look at the commentaries of Rosh Yeshiva, of great sages on Talmud, it's page after page. Let's say they read a commentary on Tractate Shabbat, so they'll do page 2, page 3, page 4, that's how they did it. And that's how the Netziv did it. Rav Chaim's co-Rosh Yeshiva. If you look at how commentaries on the Talmud are written since Rav Chaim, in the Lithuanian world, you don't have page after page anymore. Rather, you have discussions of sugyot. They'll pick a topic on this sugya and that sugya, and then they'll go and they'll give you, when you read their books, their chidushim, what you're reading are their shiurim. They'll start with the Talmud, move into the Rambam, the arguments, the discussions, but it's no longer page after page where you could have a comment maybe of 4 lines, of 10 lines. It's very different. Very different. And this really goes back to Rav Chaim. So now let's return to the Ridbaz. For all the justifications in the world, this is not going to be acceptable for a traditional teacher like the Ridbaz, who couldn't, as we'll see in a few minutes, I'll read you what he says about the Lithuanian rabbis, he could not stand changes, he could not stand what he thought was destroying or just uprooting the traditional approach to anything, certainly not Talmud study, and therefore he writes what he writes. An album picks up on it to really blast him. Now, I don't want to go into any more detail of this dispute. Let me just say that the hatred between the two are incredible, between Album and Ridbaz. We have other examples of hatred, obviously, rabbis writing about other rabbis, but I think that anyone who reads it, though, can't help but feeling sorry for Rabbi Shimon, sometimes he writes an album, who, from all reports we have, was a reliable, talented rabbi, not one of the Gedolei Yisrael, there's no question about that, and in comes to his town one of the great geniuses, important figures, and basically pushes him aside and turns him into a nobody. I think it does say something for the Ritbaz that everywhere he went, there was disputes. He was not an easy person. We have Gedolim who are like this. Yaakov Emden is another one. In a future Sfarim blog post, I'm going to reveal some new information that the Ritbaz in one of his books alludes to something. An album in his book attacks the Ritbaz for it, but it's very ambiguous. You don't know what they're referring to. Which other rabbi in the city is the Ritbaz attacking? I have unpublished memoirs of a great Lithuanian Rav, who I will deal with in my next Sfarim blog post, who comes from that city, or he spent time in that city, and he reveals, this was written 40 years ago, but he talks about this great dispute that the Ritbaz was involved in, and so I'll reveal that. It does seem that the Ritbaz came to town, started acting like a king, never reaching out to Album, seeing if they could work together. It could be I'm wrong. It could be that there's more to the story. But from reading both sides of it, it does seem like the Ritbaz just expected that Album would become one of his chassidim. And instead, when Album decided, and we've had plenty of examples of this, where one Rav comes to a town, and he assumes that he's greater. He is greater than the other Rav. What's the local Rav supposed to do? Let's say you're a Rav of a shul. And into your city moves a great sage, a Rosh Hashiva or something. What are you supposed to do? Are you supposed to all of a sudden now give up your autonomy? That was the situation. David Eisen. No, I think it's the second thing. The tradition is that they went to Kutchim. First of all, they had this approach. They had this understanding that they could that the approach could be applied to any area. But traditionally, it's said that they went to Kutchin because this hadn't been studied. And they had a chance to do something there. I don't know, though, whether they studied more in Kutchin than in other areas. I think the novelty was that they actually went to Kutchin and focused on that. Is anyone going to say that they focused more on Kutchin than on Bava Metzia or anything like that? When, after Rav Chaim died, his sons, Rav Moshe and Rav Elvel, they actually split up the Chidushim. Rav Elvel, I believe, got the Kutchim, and so I think that's what it is. Rav Chaim, you ask a good question. You know, though, maybe you don't know Avadi, Rav Chaim was not a posek. He didn't poskin. His sons did. No, I shouldn't say his sons. Rav Moshe Soloveitchik poskin. Rav Moshe Soloveitchik becomes the Rav in Rasayin. And then Chasavich, and he has to paskin, and I'm sure his psukim were unusual. There were some unusual psukim. Some of you might know that when Rav Moshe went off to his first position, Rav Chaim says to him, first of all, he told him what the purpose of a Rav is. Many of us think the purpose of a Rav is to answer shilas and do all these other things, cover up for our colleagues who are involved in all sorts of problems, if you've been following the news recently. No, Rav Chaim says the point of a Rav is to take care of the widows and the orphans. Everything else is secondary. But he told Rav Moshe, this is one of the things he told him, important things. Whenever a case comes up on Yom Kippur about someone who is ill, don't be concerned about shiurim, eating in small portions or anything. Let them eat normally. Rav Chaim was attacked for being lenient on Yom Kippur, and his reply was that he's not lenient on Yom Kippur. He's strict when it comes to pikuach nefesh, saving people's lives. Why is this a big thing Rav Chaim told his son? Because the Shulchan Aruch says that if someone's ill, you need to follow shiurim. You need to follow, you drink a little bit or eat a little bit and wait a few minutes. As you can't eat, just sit down and start munching on a food like you normally do. Rav Chaim rejected the Shulchan Aruch in this area. And Rav Elvel later explained why he rejected the Shulchan Aruch. Why didn't Rav Chaim paskin? Rav Zevin discusses it in Ishiva Shitot. He says that Rav Chaim would have all sorts of new ideas, and this would overturn halacha and the Shulchan Aruch, and traditional halacha, and Rav Chaim had too much respect for the halacha system. So he therefore didn't paskin. And we've spoken about in the past classes about things we're playing. We spoke about last semester. They didn't briskers to this day. Don't wear tzitzis on Shabbos. The Shulchan Aruch says you do. We spoke about their views of the fast. They have all sorts of radical ideas. So therefore, what happens? Reb Chaim is a rub in Brisk. He takes over after his father. He doesn't paskin. He brings in Rav Simcha Zelig from Volozhin. And the Volozhin had a kolel of training practical rabbonim. Rav Simcha Zelig becomes the dying of Brisk. And then when Reb Chaim dies, Rav Velvel Soloveitchik never paskins. Rav Simcha Zelig becomes the posek in Brisk. As we spoke about last semester, was it this semester maybe, Rav Chaim and Rav Velvel didn't even hold of the Erev in Brisk. Rav Simcha Zelig paskin for the Erev because the people refused to accept what the Rav of the city said. The only time they would paskin are in areas that were important to them, such as Pikuach Nefesh and others. So to answer your question, Ovadia, no woman ever came to Rav Chaim and ever came to Rav Velvel and asked about a chicken, Erev Shabbos. That was Rav Simcha Zelig's place. But Rav Moshe Soloveitchik, they did come. And he paskened. Look, as the Rav says, Rav Soloveitchik paskened also. He paskened Halacha Amaisa for his community in Boston for 50 years. He paskened for the RCA and others. The Rav is saying in his essay is, that's not the ultimate. You have to do it because it needs to be done. But understand that the ultimate is the theoretical halacha. And when you have this approach of the theoretical halacha, you often could be led to sakim that don't follow. I think the Hebrew expression is they don't olech batelem. They don't go in the normal path. They'll come up with new ideas. And that's where Rav Soloveitchik gets some of his new ideas. Now, that's the Ritzvah's criticism is that it's a new method, it's not traditional. The other great criticism of the Brisker method is by Rabbi Chirak of Weinberg. And I have his letters here. Rabbi Chirak of Weinberg says the problem with the Brisker method is it's not historical. That is, it doesn't reflect the way of thinking of the Rambam. And this is also the viewpoint of the Sephardic scholars. If you'd ask Jose Faur, not just Jose Faur, this great Sephardic poskim, they would tell you that if you want to understand halacha in the Rambam, you can't approach like Reb Chaim. Reb Chaim approached this in a vacuum. He looked at the halacha, he looked at the Talmud, and he created his brilliant understanding. However, if you want to understand the approach of the Rambam, they'll tell you, is first of all, you have to look at the tradition. The Rambam is a continuation of the tradition of the Rif and the Gaonim. The Spanish tradition and the Gaonic tradition. So therefore, you need to look at all the Rambam's predecessors. You have to look how the Rif understood it. You have to look how the Gaonim understood it. And then you have to look at the successors of the Rambam. Rav Avraham ben Rambam, the other people in Egypt, because they had a living tradition of Talmud study. And none of these, not the Rambam's predecessors, nor the Rambam's successors, looked at the Rambam or looked at the Talmud or anything in an analytical approach. That's number one. Number two, and Rabbi Yechiel Weinberg mentions this specifically, you have to look at the other works of the Rambam. Look, for example, at the commentary on the Mishnah. Look at the Rambam's responsa. The Rambam is asked a number of times about various halachot, things that he wrote that appeared very difficult. And as Rabbi Weinberg points out, he never responds and gives an analytical answer, a conceptual answer. He gives simple answers. Sometimes he even says he made a mistake. That's significant because we have an example where the Rambam, in one of his responsa, says that he's wrong and you should correct your edition of the Mishnah Torah. And Reb Chaim knew this because it's quoted in the Kesef Mishnah. And yet Reb Chaim ignores the Rambam's own responsa. And Reb Chaim explains analytically what the Rambam says in the Mishnah Torah, even though the Rambam himself tells you that he made a mistake. And the Chazon Ish says to Reb Chaim, how can he say he's wrong? The true text is what the Rambam tells him in his responsa. Reb Chaim had this understanding that the Mishnah Torah is its own independent work. It's a very postmodern understanding. The Rambam doesn't own the Mishnah Torah. The Mishnah Torah exists on its own, and we can explain the Mishnah Torah even in opposition to how the Rambam himself explains it. It assumes a life of its own. For Weinberg, this makes no sense. And he says that he told Rav Moshe Soloveitchik that even, let me read you what he says he told Rav Moshe Soloveitchik. No. He says that even though the Chidushim of Rav Chaim are true from the standpoint of logic, they're not true from a historical standpoint, because Rav Chaim had a different approach than the Rambam. Weinberg says Rav Chaim was himself a new Rambam. He was such a genius. But you can't put his explanations into the Rambam. They just don't work. Most people who would say that the Rav Chaim's explanations don't work would say, then what's the point of studying them? No, Rabbi Yaakov Weinberg develops the idea that they're true. In a Torah sense, they're true, but not in a historical sense. Let me read you what else he says. He says that let me read you the best passage here. There's a lot of good passages here. How about Reb Chaim created a new approach with logic in the yeshivas. Everyone wants to have a share in analysis, and therefore all the yeshiva students want to create chidushim. They went to Reb Chaim's method. This also explains historically why the method became so popular, because everyone can offer, you know, if you're just smart, you can come up with these analytic approaches. And therefore they prefer Reb Chaim over everyone else. But if you want to understand, let's say, what Rabbi Akiva Eiger says, you need to understand all of Shas. You need to have great, not just a great mind, but great amounts of knowledge. And then he goes on to say that Reb Chaim's language, he's worthy of being a new Rambam, because it's brilliant, but historically it's not true. So what are you studying then? If you're not studying truth, Rabbi Lichtenstein has an essay about this. And he explains that there's a notion of chidush, that something doesn't need to be historically true to be Torah true. And therefore, when we offer explanations of, let's say, the Rambam or someone else, this doesn't mean that the Rambam thought of it. But it's enough that it fits into the Rambam's structure, that we can read it into him. Yonasan Ibshitz says about the Shulchan Aruch. He says that sometimes we give explanations of the Shulchan Aruch, and the Shulchan Aruch definitely didn't think of this. But it doesn't matter if he thought of it or not, because it's as long as it can be read into the text, the works assume a life of their own, and they continue on. Now, Rav Lichtenstein, in his essay on this, distinguishes between practical halacha and theoretical halacha. In pure Talmudic study, all of us have this certain aspect that we give to Torah study. We can build Torah study, create new ideas, and offer explanations, and it really doesn't matter at the end of the day if, let's say, the Rambam or Rashi would recognize what we're saying, and it doesn't have to matter. Because that's basic to Torah, that we can add new stuff, and the previous writers aren't, Rambam maybe isn't even aware of all the brilliance in his writings that we can bring out. That's basic to modern literary analysis. Or Rav Lichtenstein says that in practical halacha, you can't work like that. You have to be certain, or as certain as you can, that what you say reflects historical intent. Now, I don't know if I agree with Rav Lichtenstein on this. In fact, I don't agree with him. It's a big debate in the Supreme Court in America. Do decisions have to reflect historical intent or not? And I don't think that the historical intent is important even in practical halacha. But that's Rav Lichtenstein's position. Let me see, before we move on, what some of you say. That's what we spoke about last time. Lumdus is sophisticated. It's if you study philosophy or mathematics, then you need sophistication, and the old method is more of just information. A lot for much of the old method is just information, more information. And look, I'm a great fan of Avadi Yosef, but when you read his Tshuvot, it's just information on top of information, lots and lots of information. But where's the analysis? Where's the conceptualization? It's the sort of thing that people can get tired over. So where's the learning here? This doesn't do the trick for people who, especially not European brilliant students in the Lithuanian yeshivas. Alvadia, it's not the great lamdan of the town. He didn't run. Reb Chaim didn't go to Reb Simcha Zelig for Shilas. Reb Chaim paskin for himself and for his family. However, he didn't paskin for the community, and it was always understood, and it's understood to this day. I once asked Chaim Soloveitchik, about one of his father's views, and he says, we do not tell us. This goes against the whole Brisker approach, the whole family approach. In other words, these ideas were for the family alone and for some of the top students, which is why I wrote on the Sfarim blog at this machzor of Dr. Lustiger, which gives all the hanhagot to Rav Soloveitchik. This goes against Rav Soloveitchik's whole approach. It's one thing if you have an article or put an introduction, but when you're reading that machzor for Rosh Hashanah, it tells you on the spot what the Rav did here and there, and in the Rav's own minion. In Maimonides, they didn't follow these hanhagot. So what's the point of putting them on every page of the machzor? People are going to see it and say, well, I'm going to follow like the Rav. During Chazar HaShashas, I'm going to stand there with my feet put together. Before the Rav came up with this chiddush, I think it's the Rav's chiddush, by the way, not Rav Moshe or Rav Chaim. No one ever stood up for Chazar HaShashas, thinking that they're fulfilling the... It's a reading in the Rambam. It's a kiyum of the mitzvah of Esrei and all. That's the Rav's idea. So yes, Rav Chaim paskin for his family, but he wouldn't paskin for the town. I don't see why that's unusual. When there was an Aguna case, and Rav Zevin brings down an Aguna case in Brisk, Rav Chaim didn't want to paskin it. He sent a letter to Rav Yitzchanan with all the details, and he told Rav Yitzchanan to telegraph him, send a permitted or forbidden. All he wanted to know was if the woman could remarry. He didn't want a response, and he said the reason he didn't want Rav Yitzchanan to write up a whole response and explain it, because he says, whatever Rav Yitzchanan says, I'm going to refute, or I'm going to disagree with. However, I can rely on Rav Yitzchanan if he tells me, mutter or usser. However, Rav Chaim's method was so different to Rav Yitzchanan that Rav Yitzchanan is going to send him a response, and Rav Chaim's not going to be able to, he's on a different wavelength. He's not going to be able to follow the logic. He's going to reject everything he says. But it's not a question that Rav Chaim would send the women to the Dayan. In Brisk, you had a Dayan. This is no different, Ovadia, than in the city of Belz. In Belz, you had the Rebbe, and you had the Dayan. No woman with the poor chicken went to the Rebbe to ask him about the chicken. You went to the Rebbe for a bracha, for this and for that. So the same thing in Brisk. The women didn't go to Reb Chaim. Reb Chaim was the general spiritual leader, and he did other things. But if you wanted to know a practical question, you went to the technician in town. And that was Rav Simcha Zella Grieger, the Dayan of Brisk. I never heard that Rav Chaim's wife said that his kashrut should not be trusted. I will tell you a true story that Professor Chaim Soloveitchik told shortly after Rav Soloveitchik's passing at the RCA, one of the RCA rabbinic get-togethers. And I think that this talk he gave probably put in his mind the first thoughts, which later became the famous article, Rupture and Reconstruction. He told the story that when his mother was in the hospital, his mother died in 67, and she came out of the hospital, she came into the kitchen and she saw that she started screaming at them that they traced up her kitchen. I mean, what do they know about how a Jewish kitchen is supposed to be run? They know halacha, they know the Shulchan Aruch, they know other things. So therefore, according to Shulchan Aruch, of course, you can have a dairy... plate in the meat sink. You can have the dishes together. This is not about halacha. This is about what became traditional kitchen approaches from mother to daughter. So he described how his mother comes home and is screaming at them for trafing up her kitchen. And he didn't explain the details what it is, but I know what it is. And I said, the milchik and the fleishik silverware together and in the same sink and all these sorts of things. Maybe they didn't cover up the table. And look, we've spoken in many times. If you look at what the halacha is and what people do, they're often very different. We're coming to Pesach soon, right? Look in the Shulchan Aruch. You have to eat, cover your countertops with tinfoil and all this sorts of things. These are not, you don't find this in the Shulchan Aruch, but this is the sorts of things that develop. So I think, David, that's maybe what you're referring to. I know a lot about Reb Chaim. I've never heard anything about his wife saying that, but I guarantee you that Reb Chaim's kitchen was constructed and functioned in accordance with Reb Chaim's wife. Women ran the kitchen, and how did they know it? His wife couldn't read Yoredeya, and she didn't know Halacha. She knew because her mother taught her how to run a kitchen, and this went back for hundreds and hundreds of years. It's only in modern times now that we have Sfarim telling us how to run a kosher kitchen. You've never had that before. Both, and this led to various chumras. For example, you can certainly serve cold cuts on a dairy plate, but try telling any, and Professor Chaim Soloveitchik mentions this himself in one of his articles, try telling this to any from Balabasta that you can serve a cold cut on a dairy plate. So that's an example of where it's more stringent. And then we have other examples where, according to Halacha, it would say one thing, but the tradition was to be more lenient. Gadol Talmud Shemevi Yudei Maisa. Rabbi Soloveitchik speaks about this in Halacha Command. He mentions that, and I forget now how he quotes that passage. That I'll bring it in. I think I remember what he does with it, but I don't want to say it because I'm afraid I might misquote him. But I will, next time we meet, I'll read you. Or you can, I'm sure the class is interested, so I'll bring it in. You're right, that seems to, there's a passage in the Talmud that says the whole greatness of learning is that it leads to practice. And there was a dispute. What's most important, more important, practice or theory? But what's the actual wording of the Gemara? I don't want to quote Rav Soloveitchik. He has a read of that. Okay, I see it's already 10 o'clock. There's still more we need to do. I'm going to quote you what Rav Zevin quotes from the Ridbaz when he came to Israel, also what he said about this analytic approach. And then we're going to get into, when we pick up next semester, the Ridbaz was not one to go to the land of Israel and live out his life in peace. Sit and learn and quiet. No, he becomes very involved in the Shemitah controversies and great dispute with Rav Kook, leading Rav Kook to write what I think might be his most significant and interesting letter, important letter, on how to relate to the non-Orthodox. Many of you will be very surprised by what he says, because you have this understanding that Rav Kook was like some Chabadnik who loves all non-religious. Not that at all. It's a very important theological document. For some reason, it has yet to be translated to English. It's about 20 pages. I don't know why it hasn't been translated to English. And we will deal with the dispute of the Ridbaz and Rav Kook, an important dispute. And we'll conclude with how this all plays out in terms of Kirov. I have lots more. I also want to read you, when he's in the land of Israel, he writes a Sefer, and in the introduction, he gives his reflections on what Jewish life is like in Lithuania and how the rabbis are failing the people. So if you think what he says about America is harsh, wait till you hear what he says about the rabbis, just to whet your appetite. The children, he says. He says the sons and daughters of the rabbis in Lithuania are the worst. They're worse than anyone else, in terms of, as to use the expression we say today, going off the derech. But he also attacks the rabbis, and he sees them as failing. And we will get back to this all when we pick up. I don't know the schedule. I will be here Thursday night if anyone wants to join me. I know they're charging $10, but it's actually only Canadian $10. We hope to have a good class on Torah study on Christmas Eve, the history of the practice. I will pick up, all of you who've signed up will get an email, I guess sometime in February. Next semester, we'll conclude the Ridbaz. We're going to do Rav Henkin, Eliezer Berkovitz. And I'm not sure the next person, maybe the rabbis of Frankfurt, maybe Rav Aaron Cutler. There's a lot of people I could do. So let me look at the questions. Oh, let me also conclude before I get to the questions. Again, I want to thank all of you. This semester, I learned a lot, again, from the questions. I've only been able to answer a couple of the emails that I've received, many, including many people who listen, not live. And I thank you for all of you who have written to me and told me that the sort of stuff we're doing is not done anywhere else. I don't know if that's true, but maybe it's true. And if it's true that no one else online is doing the sort of stuff we're doing here, well, then I'm very happy. I thank you for all the comments and things you've pointed out, and hope to continue again. So let me look at some of the questions here. Email me and I will send you the Frankfurt pamphlet. Okay, I will get back to the Rakefet's claim that he ran away on Shabbos. There's no evidence, there's no sources. That's an oral tradition that he must have heard growing up. The tradition is that the Ridbaz was locked in a freezer by some gangsters, and when he got out, he knew that his life was in danger, so he ran away. I will next semester deal with that, and I'll also deal with you with documented cases of where rabbis were attacked, physically attacked. We have the case in Paterson, New Jersey, where the rabbi was, in Washington, D.C., where the rabbi was actually locked in the freezer of the place, the Rav of Washington, Gedalia Silverstone, commented it was probably the only time you had kosher meat in the freezer. I'll give you some examples of where two rabbis got in fist fights over kosheris, all sorts of crazy stuff. And when we get to Rav Henkin, we will be able to talk a little bit about how the kosheris industry develops in America, because Rabbi Henkin has a response about kosheris and hashgachas. Today there's almost, 300 or 400 different kosheris organizations. Do we need all of them? Do they serve a purpose? Rav Henkin has a response about this, and we'll talk about the development of kosheris in America. Just go to the University of Scranton website, shapirom2@scranton.edu. Okay, Ovadia. Rabbi Chaim not only knew the basic Or HaChaim in Yoreh Deh, he knew it backwards and forwards. Rabbi Yosef Dov Soloveitchik, the Rav, he taught Shiurim in Yoreh Deh at YU. So of course they knew it. Now, so you ask a good question. It's a very good question. Today you can stay in yeshiva for 10 years, and unless you go out to be a practicing rabbi, you'll never learn Yoreh Deh. If let's say you're in Lakewood and then you want to take a pulpit or open up one of these Baal Tshuva Minyanim. So they have a course there. You'll learn for 3-4 months. You'll learn Yoreh Deh. But other than that, you can come out and never having learned it. I don't think this is much different, though. In Lithuania, in the Volozhin Yeshiva or the Sobotka Yeshiva, typically Yeshiva Bachar didn't learn Yoreh Deh either. A Rav Chaim Soloveitchik was a Gadol Bisrael, so of course he learned Yoreh Deh. Any Rav who became a Gadol Bisrael or a great Talmud Chacham obviously learned Yoreh Deh. But if you were only in the yeshiva for 3-4 years, what do you need to learn Yoreh Deh for? So they didn't learn Yoreh Deh, and that tradition continues. That was thought to, you could leave it for the technicians. Truth is, however, had you been in Rabbi Soloveitchik's shiur on Yoreh Deh, you would see not just the practical halacha, and not just the halachic rulings that were not written down, but he gave, you'd also find a conceptualization. Why they don't have this in other places? Even the Rav, by the way, might have said that you don't need to do this. He was training practicing rabbis, though. So obviously, if you're learning Yoreh Deh, practicing rabbi, you need Yoreh Deh. And if you're learning Yoreh Deh, you have to add some conceptualization also, because the whole point of Torah study, its supreme value, is conceptualization, and that's combined with the practical. But if all you were doing was learning for the sake of learning, what do you need to learn Yoreh Deh for? You can learn Kutchin, you can learn other things. Yoreh Deh is not any more valuable than the others. And if the whole point is to not be involved in practical halacha, so it makes perfect sense why they, and this is the Lithuanian tradition. This is the way it was in the Volozhin Yeshiva. This is the way it was in the, although in the Volozhin Yeshiva, they learned every masechta. Not like today where they just pick certain masechtas. But practical halacha was not focused on. And if you're interested in Avadia, take a look at Ish Halacha Halachic Man, and you'll see the justification for this approach. You might not buy it. I don't think you will buy it as a follower of Rav Avadia, but that was the approach. Okay, I'll stay on a few more minutes for some questions. Sure, there are yeshivas today. If you look in my last forum blog poster, the one before, I quoted from a Rosh Yeshiva, who I sent him volume 2 of the writings of Yechiyak of Weinberg, and he picked up on this passage that I quoted to you, where Yechiyak of Weinberg speaks about Rav Chaim's method and compares it negatively to the Vilna Gaon. How, unlike what Soloveitchik said, that Rav Chaim had a better understanding, no, it's not true. The Vilna Gaon was focused on original intent. And this Rosh Hashiva, who I won't mention who, because I don't know if he wants this public, he says that that's our approach. We don't follow the analytic approach. We follow the practical halachic approach, like the Vilna Gaon. In the Ashkenazic world, the Lithuanian world, mostly it's a conceptual type approach, but Sephardim do not have that. And there are some yeshivas in the Ashkenazic world that don't focus on, but really, most do, because if you hire a Lithuanian Rosh Yeshiva, the Lithuanian Rosh Yeshiva has been trained this way, and it is the highest method of Torah study that we have. Whether it's true or not, I don't know, but it's the highest method. Weinberg himself says that he never bothered to make the acquaintance of Rav Chaim. and his own Torah study lost a great deal because of that. So from a purely intellectual standpoint, the Lithuanian method is far in advance, far away more advanced than the other approaches. Okay, I see. If anyone... Wait, 2 more minutes. Yes, the Ritvaz gave Rav Herzog Smicha. I don't know after how many meetings. It was. I'll tell you when. The next class we get to, the Ritvaz returns to Europe. And that's where he gives him Smicha. In the biography of Rav Herzog, it might have that, but I don't have the biography at home. So I don't know. But when you say after one meeting, I mean, I'm wondering, Yisrael, why you obviously think that's significant. But that's how most people got Smicha. The way you got Smicha in Eastern Europe is you went to the Rav of a city, you sat with him for a few hours, he tested you, and then he gave you Smicha. In some cases, he would have you stay with him a whole day, maybe even overnight, but and then he gave you Smicha. But that's what Smicha was. You went to him, and you sat with him, and it's not just then, it's today too. You can go to a great rabbi, you can go to Rav Zalman Nechemia Goldberg, you can sit with him for an hour, he'll test you, and then they'll give you Smicha. You went to Rav Mesas, you sit with him for an hour, he'd ask you questions, give you smicha. And that's the first time you've ever met these rabbanim, and it might be the last time. So that's the way smicha's always been done. The idea that we have today, that you enroll in a program, yeshiva university or somewhere else, and you sit and you learn for many years, that's a new thing. In the Lithuanian yeshivas, they give everyone's a rabbi. So what happens is you sit and learn for, let's say, 4 or 5 years, and then when you get married, you leave the yeshiva, they give you smicha, but you never learn Yerodea or anything like that. They just give you smicha. You can't paskin. It's not a smicha that allows you to paskin. In Lithuania itself, Shaul Lieberman writes this in his responsum on, which I published in my Lieberman Quintus, on women's ordination. He says that in Lithuania it was very easy to get smicha. And it's well known that Rabbi Yochanan Spector was very easy to get smicha. And Lieberman says this was done as the way of encouraging people. Young Talmidei Chachamim, it was a way to encourage them to continue learning. So giving smicha after one meeting is not unusual. That's the standard. That's how it's usually done. When Rabbi Yaakov Weinberg needed smicha, he went to the rabbanim. They gave him smicha. That's how it was done. Okay, I don't see any more. Okay, another more. It's the last time, so I'll stay on to the end. I don't know. It could be. Rabbi Zalman Meltzer states, it's an amazing thing, he offers one explanation in one of his places in the Evan Azon, and he says that even though this isn't what in accordance with what you'd expect the conceptual, he says the conceptual method, Derech Havana, that's not good for everything. So he acknowledges that there are some times where the simple approach to answer a question in the Rambam is the better approach. But someone said that if Rav Zalman Soloveitchik would have seen this, he would have said, absolutely not. That you can always come up with, there's no such thing as a simple answer in the Rambam. You can always come up with a complicated conceptual answer. So I don't know. Okay, then I want to thank again all of you, and hopefully, God willing, we'll pick up in another month and a half or so, and I hope to see at least some of you on Thursday night. Good night.